You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Edgar J. Steele from the Bonner County Sheriff's Jail. This is Ed's first interview while he's in jail. Ed, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. As you said, this is the first interview that I've given since I was arrested almost a year ago, and I'm glad to have it be with AFP.
Many people are in your corner, and they want to get you out of there. We're going to do whatever we can, obviously, within the law to make sure that happens.
Well, I know that, and I tell you, I can't say thank you enough to all the people who have contributed money, who have sent good wishes, who have attended court hearings and trial, just everybody, all my new friends and my old friends. I've been overwhelmed by this, and it's been a real eye-opener for me. They say in jail that if you want to find out who your real friends are, just go to jail, because most of the people here find that the vast majority, if not all of their family, turns their back on them, that their friends turn their backs on them, that former coworkers turn their backs on them. And I can't tell you how many guys are just dead lonely sitting in jail and prison cells who feel betrayed by those who should not have left them, because you also would be amazed to learn how many of these people are actually innocent. In my case, however, I can't think of a single friend, not one single family member. I can't think of anybody who's turned their back on me, and I've been amazed and gratified. I thank you all very much.
Why don't you, for the benefit of our listeners, whatever you can talk about, I don't know if there's anything that you can't talk about, but the trial that just happened and the jury's decision, obviously most people who are listening to this broadcast are familiar with the result of that, but can you give the listeners any insight into why you think it may have unfolded the way it did?
Oh, I can, and I will, and I'll be honest with you, Dave, I can't think of anything that I'm not willing to talk about. So if you've got tough questions, please ask them. Tougher the better. How did it happen? Well, the trial was rigged to begin with, just like the recordings that I'm alleged to have participated in with Larry the Idahan hitman. The trial was rigged from start to finish, and I saw that even in the pretrial hearings. Now, the judge hears about this. He ain't going to be happy with me. Well, that's life. That's my opinion, and I'm entitled to it. And I think I can prove it, and I'm going to prove it to you right now. The first inkling that I had that things were going to be really bad was when the government filed a motion saying that they should be allowed to invade my attorney-client privilege. I was astounded to see the judge rule in their favor, and they were allowed to listen in on my private attorney-client conversations with lawyers that I was consulting about my case that I had not retained, and with retained lawyers. They were allowed to listen in and make transcripts of those conversations. The prosecutor, Tracy Whalen, even bragged to my then public defender, Roger Peavin, that she knew all of our trial strategy, as she cackled wildly. I was astounded, because he came to me and he was very angry. And rightly so, because he had learned for the first time that the feds had transcripts of my conversations with every other lawyer I had spoken to, that they had copies of letters that I had sent to and received from other lawyers. Apparently, the state thinks that it has the right to invade the attorney-client privilege of anybody who isn't the actual single attorney of record, and you're only allowed one. That ain't the law. I know it for a fact. I've read these cases. That isn't what it says. Yes, there are some Ninth Federal Circuit, which is the appellate level above this district court in Idaho, and that sits in San Francisco. There are some cases that say in limited circumstances there can be a waiver of the attorney-client privilege when one knows that one's telephone conversation is being recorded, that you thereby essentially assent to it being recorded and listened into. That's not the case in my case. First of all, I had asked the jailers if there was another phone that I could use so that I could talk to my attorneys privately without other inmates around me listening. And they said no. I had to use one of the four telephones there in the Spokane County Jail where I was then incarcerated, and nothing else. When you call an attorney on that phone, or or if you call anybody, it will tell you that it's subject to monitoring. It doesn't say it's being recorded, it just says it's subject to. And there is a written jail policy, which supposedly governs this, that says that telephone conversations will not be recorded unless there is a court order for such. There was never any such court order issued in my case. Therefore, I felt confident that my conversations with attorneys, that my correspondence with attorneys was privileged. Well, after I had a lot of it, and after I had discussed everything about my case that was possible to discuss with other attorneys, either by mail or by telephone, then I learned that they weren't privileged. Because that's when the judge ruled that the federal prosecutors could listen in and have transcripts of all those conversations, save only my public defender. Now, that may seem like a long answer, but the question you've asked is really the single question about my case. And I could sit here and carry on for an hour or two easily in fully answering the question. You can log on to the Federal District Court's website, and somewhere on there you will find the motion papers for this pretrial motion about invading attorney-client privilege. Read it. Read them both. You'll be amazed. That's the first inkling that I had that something was, well, that wasn't the first one. I mean, the day I was arrested was my first inkling. The second one really came several months later when this motion was heard and the judge ruled that the prosecution had the right to listen in to my attorney-client telephone calls and also to duplicate letters between me and other lawyers, except only my appointed public defender. And that really sucks, particularly since I didn't find out about it until after I had already extensively discussed everything that had to do with my case. We walked into trial at a serious disadvantage. And that wasn't even the worst one. Here's the worst one. 4 days prior to trial, we had a hearing about experts, my experts. I had two sound experts set up to testify. They came into that courtroom. They sat in that witness chair and took up the better part of 2 days of testimony. We took longer offering up our experts than we took in presenting my defense, because my defense went down in less than a day, and I'll tell you later why it didn't take any longer than that. It didn't take any longer than that because it couldn't take any longer than that, and I've got two people to thank for that, the judge and my lawyer. So, there we have two experts sitting on the witness stand testifying about these two audio tapes. The two audio tapes that are just too good to be true. And I say they're too good to be true, and maybe another time or even later in this recording we can talk about why they're too good to be true, but I maintain that all you have to do is listen to them and consider how inflammatory and outrageous they are, and what are the chances that something like that could have been recorded. Think back over recordings you've heard of in other cases, the actual recordings, and think how hit and miss they have been. The recordings in my case are perfect. They are complete. They are inflammatory. They have motive. They have opportunity. They have method. They are absolutely complete unto themselves, each of the two of them. And because there are two, they thereby supposedly corroborate one another. And there is corroboration on these recordings as well. It is amazing how bad they are. When I first heard them, I became physically ill. That's how good they are. I became convinced by my public defender that it actually was me on the tapes. I became convinced that I'd had these conversations, and I have no memory of it because I must have a split personality. Eddie and Hyde, I called it, because it was funny, and those who have followed my readings know that I like to bend even gallows humor into something personal. Eddie and Hyde, the classic split personality, I honestly believed it. Of course, I was still under the influence, extensively, of post-surgical drugs. I'd had 4 major surgeries in the handful of months that preceded the day of my arrest, something we can go into at another time. There are many aspects to this case. So for an extended period of time, I about 90% believed that I had really spoken on those tapes. My public defender went to great lengths to convince me of that. I became predictably very depressed because, again, those who have followed my writings know how devoted I am to my family, know how much I love my wife, Cindy, and I do, 26 years, and I sure wish I could get out of here and start our next 26 years together. I love that woman more than I can say. There is no way, absolutely no way, I would want to harm her. I would lay down my life for her in a heartbeat. And those who know me know that that's true. And that's one of the reasons that I haven't lost any friends throughout this exercise. Now, it was only a couple, 3 months prior to trial when my new lawyer, the private lawyer that I was paying out of my pocket, because finally the government returned the silver, my life savings that they had seized, they returned it, I was able to hire a lawyer. That lawyer was able to get a sound expert who analyzed the recording and got two experts, in fact, and they both came up with the same result. There was an extraordinary, their word, not mine, an extraordinary number of anomalies, of problems with those two recordings. One of those experts who had 30 or 40 years of experience in dealing with recordings, beginning with police department back east, and now has his own company doing just that, analyzing recordings, said that there were 351 of what he called electronic transient signatures. And he could distinguish between electronic and auditory signatures, i.e. anomalies or little noises on the tape that you can't even hear most of them. You can't even begin to hear them if you just listen to them, but you can see them if you put the waveform up on a scope. He said the difference between electronic and auditory is that the fall off is almost instantaneous with electronic, whereas auditory, like dropping a pen on the floor or something, sets up echoes, some of which you absolutely cannot hear, but which get picked up on a recording, and that's how you can tell the difference. 351 electronic signature transients he picked up on just one of the tapes. And the other fellow, using a different program, didn't come up with that many. I think he came up with 50-plus. But both of them agreed that it was more than they had ever seen on a similar tape. Both of them agreed that it was an extraordinary number. The one who had the 30 years experience with the police department and in his own company now went even further. He said, in his opinion, there's no question but what the tapes were false, that they had been edited. And furthermore, by analyzing the waveforms closely, he had determined that in many places on the tape, the voice purported to be mine isn't even my voice. Somebody else had said the words, and they had used readily available sound morphing technology to make it sound like my voice. And I understand that there's a recording up on the website freeedgarsteele.com, I think there are dashes in between the words, that people can listen to where somebody has allegedly used sound morphing technology in 5 minutes flat and produced something that is astoundingly like what sounds like me. The second expert, with all the police department experience, said it wasn't even my voice in a lot of places on these tapes. The first expert had more credentials. He's a true doctorate. He works for the Los Alamos Labs for the U.S. government, has done for years investigations and forensic analysis of tapes like this. Remember, he's one of the guys who said it was an extraordinary number of electronic signature transients on the tape. He was more careful, and he wouldn't go so far as to say that it wasn't my voice, because there's no way that he felt he could say that with a certainty. And he didn't go so far as to say with a certainty that the tapes had been fabricated. He did say it was an extraordinary number of transients, and that the transients were exactly what you would get if there had been splices, clips, electronic alterations to the recording. He noted that you can also get those electronic transients by doing things like turning a microphone on and off, and there's no allegation that that occurred during these recordings, by an equipment malfunction. There's no allegation of that about the recorder that was used to make these recordings, and one or two other things that are even more unlikely than those two. That doesn't leave much. What it leaves is somebody went in there and made these tapes. And when I heard that, such a relief washed over me. Because then I knew that Eddie and Hyde didn't exist. Then I knew that the tapes had been fabricated. Then I knew that I hadn't, in a drug stupor, somehow or other, hallucinated myself into a place where I believed that my wife deserved to die. That is another significant step in this case that told me something was seriously wrong. So, you know, like they say, You're not paranoid if they actually are out to get you. Or you may be paranoid, but that doesn't mean they're not out to get you. In my case, they're out to get me. I've said it all along. I've always been paranoid, but I have proof of it now, and I have one of the world's foremost leading experts, the guy who actually wrote the book, a doctor employed by the U.S. government in the Los Alamos facility, who almost says so. And I have another guy who says that and more. Now, we had a hearing 4 or 5 days prior to the trial about these experts, and you do that when there's a challenge by one side as to qualifications to testify. And the other side, the government, of course, predictably made just such a challenge to both of these experts that, in my experience, should easily qualify to testify at trial. And the judge ruled that neither would be allowed to testify. Astounding result. At the last minute, almost literally hours before trial is scheduled to begin, no continuances granted. There's no way to delay this now. And he says, my experts can't testify. What he said was that the guy with the police departments was unreliable, said he didn't have a complete enough background. Problem is that that guy was willing to express an opinion that was right on point. Yes, they're fabricated. It's not even his voice. But he's unreliable. Wouldn't even let him testify. I maintain that that was incorrect. What should have been done is he should have been allowed to testify, and the jury cautioned to give his testimony the weight that they felt it deserved. That's how you handle something like that. He was eminently qualified to testify. Now comes Dr. Papsen, the world's foremost leading authority on forensic audiology, the guy who literally wrote the book, a doctorate, and an employee of the U.S. government, who says everything up to the most inflammatory things that my first expert said. The judge said Dr. Papsen couldn't testify either. You know why? Because his testimony was irrelevant. That nobody had put into issue an allegation that the tapes were false. Excuse me, I had been talking about nothing but that up to that point. That hearing put it into issue. Listen, when I stood up on my arraignment a week after being arrested and I said not guilty, that controverted all the allegations of the government, including the tapes. When I said not guilty, that alone called their authenticity into question. But the judge said, no, they're irrelevant. Won't let you let him testify. And that was it for my experts. I wouldn't be allowed to put on any kind of evidence that the tapes were false, even though I had done more than I needed to do that. Dr. Papsen took his wife, went on vacation, a long-standing prepaid vacation of a lifetime, to Tahiti. He had been willing to stay behind if he was going to testify, and I'll be honest with you, I would have somehow found a way to compensate him so that he could then take her a couple of weeks later. There's no question about that, but the judge said he couldn't testify, so Dr. Papsen went on vacation, confident that he wasn't prejudicing my case. The first or second or third day of trial, my attorney again complained to the judge about not being able to put on this evidence, and the judge reversed himself. Amazingly enough, and said, okay, Dr. Papsen can testify. And we all went hurrah, and then we remembered that Dr. Papsen is off in Tahiti with his wife. So my people scurried, and they got hold of Dr. Papsen, and they got him to agree to testify over the internet by video phone, you know, something like Skype. My attorney approached the judge, and the judge said, okay, that's acceptable. The morning of the day that Dr. Papsen was to testify, the judge reversed himself again on the government's motion and said, no, he's not going to allow it by video. Papsen has to be here in person, and he has to be here the next morning at 8:30 sharp from halfway around the world. Obviously, we couldn't get the guy here the following morning at 8:30. Well, there's another thing to tell you about. It's almost impossible to get him here at 8:30 in the morning. Turns out it was impossible, but I'll tell you about that in a moment. There's something you need to understand about trial witnesses, especially expert witnesses, in order to really get what I'm about to tell you about what the judge did next. You have to understand that if a witness has not been served a subpoena, you don't have an issue on appeal about that witness not testifying, and you don't have a basis for asking the judge for a continuance or a delay in the trial. If you've got the guy under subpoena and he doesn't show up when he's supposed to, then you can go to the judge and say, "Judge, I did everything I was supposed to do. He's just not obeying the subpoena. Issue a warrant for his arrest and threaten him with contempt of court. You know, it's your job to get him here. Now I did what I was supposed to do." As a practical matter, there are a lot of witnesses who, if you give them a subpoena, will become hostile to you. And Dr. Papson, being the prima donna that he is, and knowing that he had this prepaid vacation scheduled that he had already offered to forego if he was allowed to testify, he told us that if we put a subpoena on him so that he couldn't leave the country in the face of the judge having ruled that he couldn't testify, that if he ended up testifying, he would not be a good witness for me. You get that all the time from witnesses. Don't put a subpoena on me, you won't like what I'll say. And so as a trial lawyer, you need to make a choice. Do you put a subpoena on a guy and run the risk of alienating him, or do you play ball with him? I knew this was going on. In writing, I gave to my attorney the following. I said, "Lay a subpoena on Dr. Papson so that we preserve the issue for appeal." Gave it to him in writing. He understood that, nodded, and said, "Okay." He didn't do it. He decided on his own and without telling me not to put a subpoena on Papson because I knew how important it was. He was my whole case. And as it turns out, he was my whole case. Remember I said that things can be too good to be true? Like those tapes that they alleged that I discussed the plot twice with this North Idahoan hitman? They're too good to be true because of their content. Well, unfortunately, my lawyer's too good to be true, too. And he's a very good lawyer, and that's the problem. He's a gunslinger. It's like when I went to school, I was good enough that I could get decent, I could get good grades, very good grades, without ever taking a book home. Now, that's high school. College wasn't much more difficult. And I even earned a master's degree from Cal Berkeley without really learning how to study. It wasn't until I went to law school and I was thrown up against 3.9 grade average students with 99th percentile LSATs that I finally had competition that forced me to study. And I learned how to study in law school for the first time. Well, public speaking and trial lawyering is kind of like that. If you have a natural talent for it, you never get pushed enough to really learn the craft. And unfortunately, in my opinion, Bob McAllister is cursed to have that degree of talent. He's always gotten by just winging it. That's why I call him a gunslinger. He just wanders into town and fires a couple of shots and his job is done. It don't work like that at this level of litigation. It requires greater preparation. And he didn't engage in that because he didn't know that it was really necessary. He thought he was going to ride into town, fire a couple of shots, prevail, and ride out a hero. He learned differently. So did I. Against my better judgment, I relied upon what I call speed lawyering and let him have his head. Against my better judgment, I didn't testify. Big mistake. I should have taken the stand and spent a day talking to the jury. But I have some issues with McAllister's representation, which go to the heart of why I lost. But the main issue is I didn't have Dr. George Papson on the stand to testify, essentially, that those tapes were fabricated.
Is there a chance with the appeal that you can get him back?
Yes, there is. There is a chance on appeal I can get him back. If I can get a new trial, then we can call him. And I guarantee you he'll be on the stand then. And in fact, if we can get a new trial with a new judge, we'll get that other expert on the stand, the one who said, in his opinion, my voice had been morphed from somebody else's. That's how important George Papson was. And without his testimony that essentially and substantially challenged the validity of the tapes, all we had was my wife and my kids and my friends saying, "Geez, that doesn't sound like him. We don't think he'd ever say anything like that." And they took the stand and they said that, but it wasn't enough to persuade the jury. They just thought that my wife and my friends were protecting me. Of course, that raises an interesting question, doesn't it? My wife supposedly is the victim. Supposedly, I wanted to blow my wife up with a car bomb. And yet, she's standing by me right from day one. She is standing by me again today. I mean, I talk to her two or three times a day on the telephone. I love her to pieces. She loves me. She has never wavered in believing that those tapes were false. I told her the day I was arrested they were false. I knew they were, even though I'd never heard them, because I knew I hadn't participated in those conversations. I knew I hadn't said the things that were being attributed to me. And she knows me well enough after 25 years of marriage to know it was the truth. I'm a lucky man to have a woman like that, by the way.
Yeah,
not many guys do.
I think you are. I spent many hours with your wife on the phone going over this case.
And she's a sweetheart. You know,
she's great. She's so authentic. That's why I'm surprised that the jury.
We all thought that she's so authentic and believable that she'd probably carry the day all by herself with the jury. That was a large part of why I never testified. See, I was real close to the edge and getting angry with everybody at the time. And if they'd put me on the stand, I would have ended up fighting with the prosecutor, almost certainly. And that might have worked against me more than it would have helped me. In retrospect, it was a mistake. I had to take the chance. But at the time, I bowed to the pressure from lawyers and from my wife, who didn't want me to testify, to not be my own worst enemy, as they put it. I yielded to that against my better judgment.
What are the chances of you winning on appeal? Knowing what you know and what you've been talking about, how they obviously clearly manipulated this case.
I don't know. I don't know is the honest answer. It depends upon how deep the rot goes. We're making a motion for a new trial with the trial judge. I know that's going to be denied. There's no way that this guy is going to start ruling favorably for me now. Not after what he did before trial. Not the way that he ruled on objections during the trial, because right down the line, he was a prosecuting judge. In fact, with a judge like that, you don't even need a prosecutor.
I want to ask you something about this judge. You were talking about how the judge first decided that the New York expert witness could not testify because he wasn't qualified enough. Then he said the doctor in Tahiti couldn't testify because there was no question as to the validity of the tapes. And then he ruled that, yes, he could testify, and he could testify by video conferencing. And then the government approached him, and then he said, no, I changed my mind. He has to be here at 8:30 in the morning the next day. Do these judges have that much leeway and discretion that they don't have to consult law, they don't have to consult precedents in these matters? They can just, it seems like he's just ruling like, gee, should I do this or do that? I don't know. How do I feel today? Well, you know what? I'll make the guy come in from Tahiti. Is it something like that, or am I missing something here?
No, you're not missing a thing. Feels like that to me, too. I'm not alleging that the judge is corrupt. I'm not alleging that the judge was gotten to. Trials like this happen this way with judges without any kind of bias-making pressure from anybody. Maybe that's what happened in my case, but it's awfully coincidental that in a heavily charged political case like this, that I would draw a judge like this. And I'm glad you mentioned that about Papsen again, because I promised to follow up and explain something. Papsen could have been brought back here on a commercial flight in the time we had from the time the judge changed his ruling until the time that Papsen had to testify 2 days later in the morning. However, the judge said doing it by video would be good enough. So we relied upon that. We relied upon that. Remember, we didn't have Papsen under subpoena. The following day, however, with less than 24 hours to go, the judge then reversed himself again and said Papsen couldn't testify by video. He had to be here in person at 8:30. It now was impossible to get him here commercially. We actually checked into chartering a private jet. We had enough time to get him here 8:30 the following morning from Tahiti. We found a private jet that had enough time to get there to Tahiti, pick him up, and have him in Boise by 8:30 the next morning. We actually had that lined up. I'm not even going to tell you how much it would cost because it's a mind-blowing number. But we're talking about the rest of my life here. My wife, friends, got together and said, okay, let's do this, and then found out that suddenly the charter company, for some reason that was never disclosed to us, suddenly decided that they didn't want to fly the guy back for us.
They didn't want to make money.
You got to wonder what went on. Let me tell you how much it cost. $180,000 to charter the jet and bring the guy here. We were willing to pay that. Charter company changed his mind, said, sorry, we don't want to do it. The jet's no longer available to you. It now became impossible to get him here at 8:30 the following morning, and that is why he did not testify at my trial. That is why we were unable to put on any evidence of the fact that these tapes had been falsified, even though we'd spent more than one full day a week or two earlier with these experts testifying extensively and showing waveforms as to why the tapes were falsified. We weren't able to put on any evidence of that for the jury, and that is the main reason why I lost this case.
Did the judge know that Papsen was going on vacation?
Yes, he had been told. You know, I'm not going to make the obvious connection. I'm not going to make an allegation like that out of anything more than just conjecture. I told you the facts. I've told you the truth. You draw your own conclusions. But there's a lot of things about this case that began with my arrest, which are really strange, things I couldn't make up. If you had told me about this case involving somebody else, I would have told you before I got hit with it that it couldn't happen.
Edgar J. Steele from the Bonner County Sheriff's Jail. I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to our listeners. And I want you to know we're all thinking about you and we're all with you. I know that I am. And I know enough about this case to know that you are innocent.
You know, one of the things I've noticed about this is that I don't know of a single friend that I've lost because of this. In fact, I've gotten a lot of good new ones. That says
right.
A lot. And I appreciate having friends like you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.